little man. Joe and him tells you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little girl. Joe and him tells you how to run your world, 'cause everyone's the same, choking back that nervous hurl. And if they tell you they ain't, well, they're just lying. Yeah, they're just lying.
Well, a very hearty welcome to Thinking Clearly, a show about critical thinking and related subjects. I'm Bob Frelick, and
I'm Julia Minton.
And we're here to keep you entertained, informed, and interested in the subject, hopefully. And we always like to start out by reminding our listeners that we are interactive, potentially, with you. We have a Facebook page, right?
We do. Thinking Clearly Radio. If you put that into your search bar, Thinking Clearly will probably bring up our page, or Thinking Clearly Radio. And I should say mostly Bob, puts up our promos and links to our podcast after the show is uploaded to our podcast.
Yeah, and that's a good thing, because sometimes we'll refer back to a previous guest that we've had on a previous show or a topic that we've talked about. And if you were interested in that, you can just pump out that particular episode from our archive, and you can go to that podcast by using your podcast app. Anyone will do you, Thinking Clearly, and that will get to our podcast. We're also on iTunes, or you can go directly to our podcast website, which is
thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. Yeah. So that's thinkingclearly, one word, .libsyn, which is LIBSYN.com.
Ah, very good.
And you can binge listen to all of us. Just imagine that 20 straight hours of Julia and Bob thinking clearly.
Oh, that's
how I spend my weekends, Bob.
Whole new possibility of life. You can listen to them 20 hours straight. I don't know exactly what that. We are not responsible for your mental frame of after that. But anyway, it's nice to have a podcast version, and so we welcome you to use that. And use our Facebook page to keep in touch with us. And just to reacquaint you with what critical thinking is, we have a very long description of it, but I'm just going to read the first part. Critical thinking is a mode of thinking that uses the process of logical reasoning based on a thorough examination and evaluation of a robust cross-section of evidence relevant to the issue at hand when forming claims, conclusions, opinions, and beliefs. Now, that robust search for evidence is important, because oftentimes people will do a search for just the part that confirms what they already believe.
Well, what I usually experience is I have a question or I want some more information, so I go search out more information about it. And once I feel satisfied with what I expected to find, I stop.
That's very typical. Or if you're trying to disconfirm something, you know, you search for things that will disconfirm it. That's not how we define and think about critical thinking. We think about critical thinking in terms of looking at the range of evidence, evidence that may support what your intuition says might be the answer, or to keep completely neutral about issues. That's hard to do because our intuition is kind of a driving force there. I see nothing wrong really with saying, you know, my intuition on this is, but let me go and look at the evidence. It's when you go to look at the evidence that's key, because if you then just look at evidence that confirms your intuition, you're liable to be led right along the wrong path. And so the search for the truth, the search for what is the best evidence? What is the best evidence that's out there pointing to in terms of a logical connection between that evidence and vetting evidence, and where is that evidence coming from? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot to critical thinking, and that's the sum and substance of what we get into on this show.
Yeah, absolutely. I like something you said a number of episodes ago, where when you're researching something, usually online is where we start, that you will, when you find information that is sort of what you were expecting, then you will also go and start searching for contrary information. You'll say, well, what would the counter argument be? And then go and research that. I think that is a very good example of taking an additional step we usually don't bother taking. But that additional step is what kind of opens that door to some critical thinking about the subject at hand.
Yeah, and sometimes I actually reverse that and look for the opposite first. And that leads me into a whole other set of web pages that I'm going to be if I only looked at what confirms the belief. Well, let me give you the quote for the month here, because that relates to our topic. Here's the quote. As citizens, we have to be more thoughtful and more educated and more informed. I turn on the TV and I see these grown people screaming at each other. And I think, well, if we don't get our civility back, we're in trouble. You know, mm-hmm. who's that's from?
Mm-mm.
You'd never guess. Emmylou Harris.
Huh. Well, there you go.
There you go. Everybody's getting into the whole idea that we are at some sort of a crossroads. We're at a point in our history, I think, that we haven't seen before. This is part two of a topic that we started last month that is about having civil dialogues. And last month we had Arizona University professors Clark Olson and Jennifer Lindy from Arizona State University's Institute for Civil Dialogue. They were discussing their structured method for fostering civil dialogues. What did you get from that? How did you come away from, you know, the answers that those guests gave us?
Oh, gosh. I've been just, I can't wait to get their book in the mail. I ordered it.
Yeah.
I'm still reeling from that. I think it's interesting because here we've just talked about critical thinking, which is our show, where our show, the heart of our show comes from. And now we're getting into civil dialogue. And I think those, while there's a relationship, are different. In particular, civil dialogue, we're talking about humans, people interacting with each other, exchanging ideas. It's not something that's a dry, logical, constructing an argument and checking your fallacies. It's so much more organic. There's so much more the importance of listening with an open heart, I feel is just, it's just so much more important when it comes to civil dialogue, again, because it's a human-to-human interaction. That's, for me, the biggest kind of takeaway is the heart of it really is this human experience.
I'm listening to you so intentively, I don't know what to say. the book was called Hot Topics, Cool Heads, A Handbook for Civil Dialogue. And it's really their whole effort is really more about group conversations, right? But you can apply a lot of what they talk about and probably what they'll talk about in that book to one-to-one, because I think most of our listeners are, there may be some times where you go to a family gathering and you're having a whole group or you have a group of friends that are talking about some political thing or, you know, something that's controversial and has a difference of opinion. But for the most part, a lot of our conversations are one-to-one. They can be online one-to-one or they, you know, one to whoever else is reading online what we're writing. But a lot of the civil dialogues that I find myself getting into are one-to-one.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to kind of phase into that. We're going to, first of all, remind you just a little bit about what the process was last time that the guests talked about. Do you remember their process off the top of your head?
Well, sure. They had a whole model, which I thought was really interesting because, you know, civil dialogue means one thing. They actually built a structure, a model of how to go about those civil dialogues. And like you said, they were more in groups, not one-to-one. I think they talked about four to eight usually was somewhere in there.
Well, they talked about an audience. Mm. They first of all had an audience.
Mm-hmm.
Then they put five chairs up in kind of a semicircle. And those five chairs went from a range of opinions, from strongly agree, somewhat agree, neutral, or undecided, disagree, or disagree strongly. So a range of five different levels of support of some particular statement. So, you know, they started out with a statement. So, for example, and this is not one that comes directly from them, but you might say something like, an example might be, abortion should be legal. You want to make it a statement that people can either agree or disagree with. So I just made this one up. Abortion should be legal except in cases where the mother will most likely die giving birth. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we excluded that one that probably everybody would agree with. But then you have a range of opinions on the abortion or choice side of it. So then they would invite people from the audience to occupy the chairs. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing is that they would be given the kind of guidelines. And their guidelines are participants can be passionate but not hostile. Participants should use truthful speech that does not attack others. Participants should listen respectfully while others speak. And so those are their just kind of rough draft guidelines. And then each volunteer that's in the chairs is given 1 minute to explain why they took the chair that they did. And the facilitator then...
So basically why they felt strongly or not as strongly or somewhere in the middle about the topic at hand.
Right. Yeah. Why did they come up out of the audience to involve themselves in this discussion?
I also remember something that I kind of didn't expect but makes sense was, I believe Professor Jennifer Lynn said, it's not a safe space. That's something that gets tossed around these days about whatever that means.
Yeah.
And it just kind of like it makes sense, but it kind of I had to think about it for a minute what she meant by that, because when you're bringing people together who have difference of opinions, you can't expect it to remain this utterly safe place where nothing will be said that won't disturb anybody. In fact, part of the point is to bring people out of a safe space and to interact with each other's opinions.
Yeah, and I think it really depends on how you define the word safe. Safe meaning that there is a facilitator there who will, after the folks then are given, after they've given their 1 minute reason why they have that opinion, then the facilitator sort of bows out of the conversation for about, and lets them go on for about 10 minutes, but the facilitator will come back in listening very intently to what's being said. So if someone starts to monopolize the conversation or get hostile or whatever, then the facilitator will come in, interrupt the process, and get it back into the mode of civil dialogue. So it's depending on how you define that word safe.
Mm-hmm.
Safe meaning that it's safe. With a facilitator there, it's maximizing the safety, physical safety of the person. They're probably not going to get assaulted. And
right.
The facilitator is not going to let a lot of yelling and intimidating and bullying go on. Mm-hmm. The facilitator will facilitate that. But it's not safe in that you're liable to hear something that is completely different than you believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that may even cause some unrest in you and cause some emotional reaction, okay? You're not guaranteed that kind of safety.
No, and I use safe space in the sense that it's commonly used as a autonomous space that's protects marginalized people. In other words, if you are in a queer safe space, it is not acceptable for anyone to say anything that would be derogatory or insulting to a queer person in any way, even if it's joking. So that's what I mean in the common usage of safe space.
Yes. It would not provide that kind of safety
for
a queer person. There may be someone who is saying it's against God's law or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm. And someone needs to be free to say that.
Exactly.
Because that is a difference of opinion. Now, I'm not saying they're... I didn't mean to go down the safe space route, but it was just something that got me thinking for a minute. Mm-hmm. Wow, you know, sometimes when we need to listen and talk to each other, it takes us out of our safety zone.
Exactly. Yeah. And then just to give a little closure to their process, then after this takes place, then the audience is invited to get into and ask questions and provide feedback, offer opinions and that kind of thing for another 10 minutes. So you're getting both the people in the panel and the audience involved in what's going on in the civil dialogue. And then each of the original volunteers is asked to give a closing statement, sort of a processing where they are now, did they feel like they wanted to change chairs? Did they learn anything from it? And then the facilitator thanks them, provides a summary, and that's a round of what they call civil dialogue. Now, that's something that's really can be helpful in communities. If there is an issue in the community, like in this community, we have an issue with the homeless, houseless, traveling folks
that
are
in here. Oh, only this
community? Yes. And there are people on the extremes of both sides of that and a lot of people in the middle of that issue. It's a multi-sided issue. So we've had community meetings in this community. But some of them were not civil dialogues. Some of them got out of hand.
They were always passionate, not always civil.
Yeah. And that's the thing, too, is that we're not advocating that you're not passionate in your civil dialogues, mm-hmm. because to be motivated and to appear and let it be known that you're interested and motivated in talking about a topic mm-hmm. doesn't violate the rules of mm-hmm. civil dialogue.
But also know that you might be met with an equal or more amount of passion
exactly.
from another side.
Yeah. And this has been my mode of, you know, before I started thinking about civil dialogue and getting into this issue, this is kind of my mode. Is I go eyeball to eyeball with people. If they go up a notch, I go up. That's a very dangerous
yes, it is.
Position as I'm learning and examining my own process. But at any rate, if you're in a community or an organization and you're interested in this process that these Arizona State University professors have perfected, that you can actually get in touch with them. And their website is civil-dialogue, and that's dialogue.com. And you can actually request that they facilitate a civil dialogue mm-hmm. in your area.
And I so enjoyed our conversation with them last month. In no way did I get a sense that they have ownership over this. They want to spread the word, if you will, of encouraging all of us to speak with each other more in the sort of civil dialogue.
Yeah,
I think it's also really interesting the sort of progression our own show has made from our first shows talking about how to structure an argument and fallacies and logic. That's a type of argumentation where passion is not encouraged. In fact, the removal of passion is how
yeah.
you get to truth.
Right.
And I think it's fascinating how this is so much more of, like I said earlier, a person-to-person
yeah.
experience.
See, that's why I'm so interested in this, is that I'm thinking there's a way to integrate these two. Because the way some people, and we'll get into our first clip here with Celeste Headley, and she gives 10 rules of civil dialogue. But the way some of the folks that are just into the civil dialogue but not so much emphasizing the critical thinking, the way they portray civil dialogue is that you're not really trying to persuade or put forth a strong argument,
mm-hmm.
and the emphasis is really on intently trying to understand the other's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a way to integrate the two so that we're able to have a civil dialogue based on critical thinking. And that's what, you know, that's where my thinking is going mm-hmm. with this, is to synthesize, integrate those two and synthesize a way that they can both be compatible.
Mm-hmm. Well, stay tuned, folks. We're not putting ourselves out of business tonight.
All right. So let's go ahead. And I had some definitions of civil dialogue, but I think we've described it fairly well. And so let's go ahead and get into our first clip here. But this is Celeste Headley. And this is a clip from a TED Talk that she gave a couple years ago in April 2015. And it's called 10 Ways to Have a Better Conversation. And she's an interesting person. She hosts the NPR Daily News show called On Second Thought from Georgia Pacific Public Broadcasting. And she authored the book called We Need to Talk, How to Have Conversations That Matter. So here is just kind of the start where she describes the importance of civil dialogue.
All right, I want to see a show of hands. How many of you have unfriended someone on Facebook because they said something offensive about politics or religion, childcare, food? And how many of you know at least one person that you avoid because you just don't want to talk to them? You know, it used to be that in order to have a polite conversation, we just had to follow the advice of Henry Higgins and My Fair Lady, stick to the weather and your health. But these days, with climate change and anti-vaxxing, those subjects are not safe either. So this world that we live in, this world in which every conversation has the potential to devolve into an argument where our politicians can't speak to one another, and where even the most trivial of issues have someone fighting both passionately for it and against it, it's not normal. Pew Research did a study of 10,000 American adults, and they found that at this moment, we are more polarized, we are more divided than we ever have been in history. We're less likely to compromise, which means we're not listening to each other, and we make decisions about where to live, who to marry, and even who our friends are going to be based on what we already believe. Again, that means we're not listening to each other. A conversation requires a balance between talking and listening, and somewhere along the way, we lost that balance. We've all had really great conversations. We've had them before. We know what it's like. The kind of conversation where you walk away feeling engaged and inspired, or where you feel like you've made a real connection or you've been perfectly understood. There is no reason why most of your interactions can't be like that. So I have 10 basic rules. I'm going to walk you through all of them. But honestly, if you just choose one of them and master it, you're already going to enjoy better conversations.
Okay. And we're going to hear those rules in just a minute. A little bit more about her. Actually, she's funny. And I invited her to be a guest on our show tonight, but she couldn't make it. Anyway, her book and her process and her rules here that she's going to give you are based on her being a host of a radio show and interviewing people. Mm-hmm. So it's really coming from that experience of interviewing people. So as we get into her giving her rules, you're going to see it's more, like I said before, it's more like really listening intently to the person, trying to draw out what they're saying and understand what they're saying and to take them into a deeper level of what they're saying by the questions you ask. Mm-hmm. So it's based on her being an interviewing. And so keep that in mind. We're probably going to stray from that when we develop a process where we're actually getting in a civil dialogue with people, where we're using critical thinking skills of evidence, logic, reason, conclusions, and that kind of thing. And we may want to be a little persuasive. I mean, you know, when we're talking to other people, how can we take that out? If we think we have a good idea, mm-hmm. we're going to want to be persuasive, not to the point where we're using manipulative techniques and trying to bully them into our point of view.
Well, speak for yourself.
Okay. All right. Let's go ahead and fire that clip up again.
It depends on how right you are.
Okay. Celeste.
Number one, don't multitask. And I don't mean just set down your cell phone or your tablet or your car keys or whatever's in your hand. I mean, be present. Be in that moment. Don't be thinking about your argument you have with your boss. Don't be thinking about what you're going to have for dinner. If you want to get out of the conversation, get out of the conversation. But don't be half in it and half out of it. Number two, don't pontificate. If you wanted to state your opinion without any opportunity for response or argument or pushback or growth, write a blog. You need to enter every conversation assuming that you have something to learn. The famed therapist Eb Scott Peck said that true listening requires a setting aside of oneself. And sometimes that means setting aside your personal opinion. Assume that you have something to learn. I put it this way. Everybody is an expert in something. Number three, use open-ended questions. In this case, take a cue from journalists. Start your questions with who, what, where, when, why, or how. If you put in a complicated question, you're going to get a simple answer out. If I ask you, were you terrified? You're going to respond to the most powerful word in that sentence, which is terrified. And the answer is, yes, I was, or no, I wasn't. Let them describe it. They're the ones that know. Try asking them things like, what was that like? How did that feel? Because then they might have to stop for a moment and think about it. And you're going to get a much more interesting response. Number four, go with the flow. That means thoughts will come into your mind and you need to let them go out of your mind. We've heard interviews often in which a guest is talking for several minutes and then the host comes back in and asks a question which seems like it comes out of nowhere or it's already been answered. That means the host probably stopped listening 2 minutes ago because he thought of this really clever question and he was just bound and determined to say that. And we do the exact same thing. Stories and ideas are going to come to you. You need to let them come and let them go. Number 5, if you don't know, say that you don't know.
Okay, let's just review that. Those don't multitask is the first one. Don't pontificate is the second. 3 is use open-ended questions and then go with the flow. And if you don't know, say that you don't know. Which of those grabs you?
Well, the first 2 are my favorite in that I like to pontificate and I like to multitask. But that's probably not what you meant.
The contrary, Julia, stepped into the studio tonight.
maybe not.
All right. Well, I you know, the one I like is use open-ended questions. That's my favorite because that's I have some experience in counseling, and that's a counseling technique, mm-hmm. is use open-ended questions because that way you let the person start wherever they want to start. And they're going to come up with the thing that's most prominent. And then when you have follow-up questions, again, you use open-ended questions based on their questions, like what things caused you to be, well, I just used an open question. Which of those questions grabbed you?
That's right. You're very good at that. Well, I think the difference, though, is so often when we're, and I say that when I'm having one-on-one discussions with people of differing opinions, I do want to persuade them. You know, at least on mm-hmm. a gut level,
sure.
you know, I want to persuade them. What I'm really hearing is taking that moment or a few moments to really spend that energy I would normally spend trying to change someone's mind and use that energy listening and understanding to them thoroughly, putting myself in their shoes. And mm-hmm. it may be something so completely absurd that it's hard for me to identify or to see myself living a life like them, which is why it's even more important to really to listen and to want, to desire, to really understand where that person's coming from. And I think when you have when your mindset changes in that direction, those open-ended questions are a little easier. They come
sure.
to be easier.
And you can do both in a civil dialogue.
That sounds like multitasking.
It's not multitasking
because
what you're doing is it's kind of like dancing, only you're switching leads.
Mm.
You know, part of the time one partner leads and the other partner leads. So it's kind of like that, you know. And so it's just something that the more you practice it, the more you can do it. So listening intently, trying to understand where the person is coming from doesn't mean that you agree with them.
Right.
It means that you are taking the time to understand them. But then you can have your time to give your point of view and hope that you're heard and understood.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problems come in when we take the time to have a civil dialogue with the other person and there's no reciprocation
mm-hmm.
there. Those are the rough edges around this whole idea of civil dialogue.
Although often when you exhibit those behaviors, they're mirrored back to you.
Exactly.
And I know, you know, when I come into a conversation with more patients, I often see that received back from the person I'm having the conversation with.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, if you're not getting that back, you're not feeling like you're on the same level, there's nothing wrong with opting out if you don't feel like it's going
yes.
the right direction.
You always you can talk, but you always have the opportunity to walk if you want to.
I like that. But, you know, what you just said really stuck with me is that like dancing, but sometimes you take the lead and sometimes you're led. It's kind of like changing channels. And that is something that really requires practice.
Yeah. And that's a wonder. Those are the kinds of conversations that we come out feeling good about. Both people come out feeling good about.
It's the kind of dancing I feel good about.
It is. So let's go ahead with the next 6 through 10.
Number 6, don't equate your experience with theirs. If they're talking about having lost a family member, don't start talking about the time that you lost a family member. If they're talking about the trouble that they're having at work, don't tell them about how much you hate your job. It's not the same. It is never the same. All experiences are individual. And more importantly, it is not about you. You don't need to take that moment to prove how amazing you are or how much you've suffered. Conversations are not a promotional opportunity. Number seven, try not to repeat yourself. It's condescending and it's really boring. And we tend to do it a lot, especially in work conversations or in conversations with our kids. We have a point to make, so we just keep rephrasing it over and over. Number eight, stay out of the weeds. Frankly, people don't care about the years, the names, the dates, all those details that you're struggling to come up with in your mind. They don't care. What they care about is you. They care about what you're like, what you have in common. So forget the details. Leave them out. Number nine, this is not the last one, but it is the most important one. Listen. I cannot tell you how many really important people have said that listening is perhaps the number one most important skill that you could develop. I know it takes effort and energy to actually pay attention to someone. But if you can't do that, you're not in a conversation. You're just two people shouting out barely related sentences in the same place. You have to listen to one another. Stephen Covey said it very beautifully. He said, most of us don't listen with the intent to understand. We listen with the intent to reply. One more rule, and number 10, and it's this one. Be brief.
I'll just review those. By the way, we forgot to mention that this is a call-in show, and we will take calls starting about 7:45. We still have some stuff to get through, and we welcome your calls. Around then, we're going to give the numbers out. So to review, the 6 through 10 Celeste Headlee's guidelines are: don't equate your experience with others. Try not to repeat yourself. Don't focus on the details, listen, and be brief. Which of those do you like?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Okay, got it. I know which one you don't like now. Okay, yeah.
Forget the details. That's
talking.
The hardest one for me.
It's
really the hardest.
I get nailed with that one
because
I love context.
Yeah.
And I usually start with the Big Bang and go from there. And the eyes start rolling in the back of their heads. But at any rate, so let's...
Well, I just asked you how the weather was, and you're going back to the Big Bang, you know?
The thing that we want to emphasize here is that you have to decide what your goals are in a conversation. You may want to have a goal to persuade, and sometimes that's the most appropriate goal. Mm-hmm. You use rhetoric, you use all kinds of devices, persuasive techniques to persuade, and that may be the appropriate thing to do. You may want to have a civil dialogue and really try to understand where this other person is coming from. And that's where Celeste's rules come in. She's more coming from you're interviewing the person. You're really trying to understand where it is. Or you may want to have, like I'm advocating, a dance where you are switching who is in the lead. You're attempting at times to understand them and listen and really care about their opinion. Have a lot of respect and mutuality, and then you have your chance to actually give your best argument based on evidence.
I would also say if your goal is persuasion, which it often is, the other person feeling heard is a factor in that equation of persuading them.
Yeah.
And that's something that can be kind of hard to fake. You know, just, I'm going to listen to this person yammer on while I, let them feel like I'm listening to them. And then I'm going to give them my spiel and hopefully change their mind. Doesn't work like that.
No. Wall school it.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. People can sense that on a subconscious level.
Yeah.
So I would even go so far as to say that listening and deeply understanding a person that you wish to persuade is a major factor in achieving that goal.
Yeah. And sometimes what I see a lot of is people are just flying their colors. You ever seen that? They are...
What team they're on.
Exactly. They're giving the company line for their team. Mm-hmm. And they're doing it to the audience of other people in their team.
Yes.
And showing what a great member of the team they are because they can give the company line. Mm-hmm. And that is what's prominent in their, you know, their conversation. That is by no means what I would call civil dialogue.
No, but it's part of what we do as monkeys.
Yes. And it's appropriate at times. If you're at a rally, for example, you want to do that. That's what you're doing.
That's true.
That's the appropriate. So the whole idea is to be aware of what is the context of this conversation and what are your goals in the conversation. Mm-hmm. Just own those goals.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You know, part of our description of critical thinking points to the importance of having awareness, and we've talked about this on a number of shows, our intuition, our intuitive, what we call fast thinking, and how that relates to our emotions and our values. And it's different than critical thinking, which is more the reasoning with logic and evidence. And, mm-hmm. That's called slow thinking by many people. And I thought it was interesting because there is a psychologist, his name is Rob Willer, and he's a professor of sociology and psychology and organizational behavior at Stanford University. And he did a TED Talk back last year in October. And it was called, How Do We Bridge the Political Divide? And he talks about moral reframing. So let's go ahead and get into this. This is clip 4, and this is Rob Willer.
What can we do to chip away at polarization in everyday life? What can we do to connect with and communicate with our political counterparts? Well, these were exactly the questions that I and my colleague Matt Feinberg became fascinated with a few years ago when we started doing research on this topic. And one of the first things that we discovered that I think is really helpful for understanding polarization is to understand that the political divide in our country is undergirded by a deeper moral divide. So one of the most robust findings in the history of political psychology is this pattern identified by John Haidt and Jesse Graham, psychologists, that liberals and conservatives tend to endorse different values to different degrees. So, for example, we find that liberals tend to endorse values like equality and fairness and care and protection from harm more than conservatives do. And conservatives tend to endorse values like loyalty, patriotism, respect for authority, and moral purity more than liberals do. And Matt and I were thinking that maybe this moral divide might be helpful for understanding how it is that liberals and conservatives talk to one another and why they so often seem to talk past one another when they do. So we conducted a study where we recruited liberals to a study where they were supposed to write a persuasive essay that would be compelling to a conservative in support of same-sex marriage. And what we found was that liberals tended to make arguments in terms of the liberal moral values of equality and fairness. So they said things like, everyone should have the right to love whoever they choose, and they being gay Americans, deserve the same equal rights as other Americans. Overall, we found that 69% of liberals invoked one of the more liberal moral values in constructing their essay. And only 9% invoked one of the more conservative moral values, even though they were supposed to be trying to persuade conservatives. And when we studied conservatives and had them make persuasive arguments in support of making English the official language of the US, a classically conservative political position, we found that they weren't much better at this. 59% of them made arguments in terms of one of the more conservative moral values, and just 8% invoked a liberal moral value, even though they were supposed to be targeting liberals for persuasion. Now, you can see right away why we're in trouble here, right? People's moral values, I mean, they're their most deeply held beliefs. People are willing to fight and die for their values. Why are they going to give that up just to agree with you on something that they don't particularly want to agree with you on anyway? So what would work better? Well, we believe it's a technique that we call moral reframing, and we've studied it in a series of experiments. In one of these experiments, we recruited liberals and conservatives to a study where they read one of 3 essays before having their environmental attitudes surveyed. And the first of these essays was a relatively conventional pro-environmental essay that invoked the liberal values of care and protection from harm. It said things like, in many important ways, we are causing real harm to the places we live in, and it is essential that we take steps now to prevent further destruction from being done to our Earth. Another group of participants were assigned to read a really different essay that was designed to tap into the conservative value of moral purity. It was a pro-environmental essay as well, and it said things like, keeping our forests, drinking water, and skies pure is of vital importance. We should regard the pollution of the places we live in to be disgusting. And reducing pollution can help us preserve what is pure and beautiful about the places we live. And then we had a third group of participants that were assigned to read just a non-political essay. It was just a comparison group, so we could get a baseline. And what we found when we surveyed people about their environmental attitudes afterwards, we found that liberals, it didn't really matter what essay they read. They tended to have highly pro-environmental attitudes regardless. Liberals are on board for environmental protection. Conservatives, however, were significantly more supportive of progressive environmental policies and environmental protection if they had read the moral purity essay than if they read one of the other two essays. We even found that conservatives who read the moral purity essay were significantly more likely to say that they believed in global warming and were concerned about global warming, even though this essay didn't even mention global warming. That's just a related environmental issue. But that's how robust this moral reframing effect was. And we studied it the other way, too. If you want to move liberals to the right on conservative policy issues like military spending and making English the official language of the U.S., you're going to be more persuasive if you tie those conservative policy issues to liberal moral values like equality and fairness. All these studies have the same clear message. If you want to persuade someone on some policy, it's helpful to connect that policy to their underlying moral values. Empathy and respect. Empathy and respect. If you think about it, it's the very least that we owe our fellow citizens.
We've interviewed not Jonathan Haidt, whose work that is being cited in this method, but Peter Ditto from UC Irvine, mm-hmm. who works with Jonathan Haidt. So if you want to go back and listen to that, it's we're talking about motivated reasoning with Dr. Peter Ditto. It's our 17th episode. And you can go to our podcast to listen to that. We also have talked about framing, because this reminds me of framing, mm-hmm. right? And we talked about framing and narratives as ways of sort of dissolving that wall between us and somebody who has quite different values. Mm-hmm. My question to you, Julia, is this appropriate if we're trying to do a critical thinking argument? Because we're sort of using a manipulative device here to give our point of view and dissolve some of those walls. We're using language that appeals to what we know that other person's values may be. Mm-hmm. So my question is that appropriate in a civil dialogue using critical thinking, in your opinion?
I would ask right back at you, are you falsifying any information?
No.
Okay, well, that's a pretty good start.
You're framing an issue. You're using a certain set of language that you feel will be better received.
So just like when we talked about framing, yeah. you can take a picture mm-hmm. and you can put a frame around it, or maybe you're cropping that picture so it has the most artistic appeal. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, you're inherently not showing all of that picture. Of course, that picture could never capture everything to begin with. Am I extending my metaphor too much here?
No, you're coming through loud and clear. because I was thinking about this, but your first question is: are you falsifying? Are you telling any lies? Are you distorting something? Are you leaving something out? No. So your answer would be that yes, it would be appropriate. That would be compatible with a critical thinking, civil dialogue approach.
I would say yes, although I do think it can also, you can use that tactic and still not falsify information, but you can skew, you can portray something in such a skewed light that I do think you can, it is possible to get into ethically questionable territory. Mm-hmm. So that brings me to statistics. Statistics are just numbers. They're in black and white. They're absolutely true, but boy, you can paint some different pictures. So I think as long as the general gist of what you are conveying is a sentiment that's true to the facts and the truth, and you're not going out of your way to present something that's intentionally skewed, I don't see a problem with it. And I think it's something that we do subconsciously a lot of the time. So mm-hmm. to use that same tactic in a conscious way, I would think we'd be just as ethical, yeah. if not more.
Although according to the person we were listening to, the more normal is to just mirror our own values, you know, than rather than to portray what we're trying to communicate in terms of the values of the other person. But
and that brings me back to exactly why it is so important to deeply listen to,
yes.
and understand where someone is coming from. Because I bet you if that conservative had practiced putting themselves in the position of that liberal argument, or the liberals spent the time and the energy putting themselves into that conservative argument, they might be more prepared to make the pitch to the other side.
Yes.
So,
and you know what? We have a caller who's been patiently waiting. Thank you for calling Thinking Clearly. Welcome, caller.
Hello, caller.
I was just calling to say I definitely don't think it's unethical to try to like approach a conversation, you know, taking into consideration who your audience is. Mm-hmm. I think that's all it really is it's not, you know, it's like, because there's a million arguments I could make for, you know, why we should do X, Y, or Z as a society. But, you know, it's better to start with the one that will be most applicable to whoever you're talking to, you know. And I'm a very fixed person who's very decided on what I think is right and wrong. So I definitely usually approach things from that way. But it's also important to, like you're saying, you know, always be open to hearing what other people have to say and being willing to let them convince you, too, which is a really kind of dangerous place to live. It's like, oh, I'm always open to being convinced. Even though some of us aren't really.
That can be a vulnerable way to live.
Very, very good point. And it's one that we'll all hear in any speech class that we ever take. Know your audience. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, caller.
Thank you.
And welcome to Thinking Clearly.
I have learned that it is very good sometimes to just be silent, be with a dear friend. We don't have to talk all the time. It is so sweet to be together. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, caller.
I'm not going to say a word. Good. That reinforces, you know, the silence is very powerful, especially if you're one-to-one. It's a little awkward on the phone, but if you're one-to-one, you can be attending to that other person by your eye contact, your body language, and yet not put your voice in the air, and it's interpreted as receptive, that you're being receptive. So thank you very much for that, caller.
It's true. It's I think, again, coming back to that human to human connection, just being with someone and not having to feel the need to always have the next thing to say or to be entertaining, I think is a tender thing and can put you in a place of vulnerability where your hearts can open and you can have a mutual understanding.
Exactly. Did we alert the audience as to what our next show might be about?
I don't think we've said anything.
We haven't said anything, huh?
We haven't told anyone. Well, the big surprise.
Should we keep it a secret or should we tell folks? I'm taking direction on this.
Well, I think we're discussing having a part three civil dialogue.
Oh, okay.
Because this is just too juicy of a
That's
topic.
That's an entree if I've ever heard one. Well, yeah, and we've been grappling with this because this is such an important topic that, you know, we started out with one episode and then thought, we need another episode. And in talking about this, Julie and I, we have great discussions after this show. And so we thought, what we would do in our next show, this is not a firm commitment if we have to get a topic, what we hopefully will do is to demonstrate, Julia and I, a impromptu, we're not going to rehearse this, discussion within the context of critical thinking and civil dialogue, and we'll have a facilitator in here.
Well, that's what we usually do, is we discuss things, we talk, we yammer on. But in this case, we're going to discuss something we don't agree on.
Yes.
Because so often here we are just saying, oh, yeah, Bob.
Yeah, right. And but we've identified post-show differences of opinion that we come to. When you talk at deeper and deeper levels with almost anybody, you're going to find some areas. And that's the beautiful thing about any kind of great dialogue that you're having with people, is you're able to identify common ground and identify differences that you have and explore those. And you may come to the point where you're saying, we have to agree that we have differences, but at least we know what those are.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And so so that's what we intend to do. Again, it depends on us finding an appropriate topic for that.
A radio-friendly topic.
Yes, radio-friendly.
Well, Bob and I have found plenty of things to disagree on. They're not always radio-friendly.
Yeah. We got about 6 minutes left. We don't have any other callers yet, but we be able to take another caller or so.
Cue last-minute caller.
But let's wrap up the clips that we're doing with one more clip. There's a lot of people that are working in civil dialogue now, because obviously we're at a point in our history where there's a lot of incivility in our
dialogue.
There's
a lot of work to do.
And another person is Krista Tippett, and she's a Peabody Award-winning broadcaster and New York Times best-selling author and podcast host of On Being. So this short clip is the introduction to an interview that she did with a woman whose name is Frances Kissling, who is known for her longtime activism on the abortion issue. But Frances has devoted recently her energy more in the recent years in developing real relationships and new conversations across the bitter divide of abortion. And so we're going to listen to this clip with Krista Tippett and Frances Kissling.
She is best known as an activist in the abortion debate. But this hour, for the Civil Conversations Project, we draw out lessons from Frances Kissling's less famous adventures of new relationship with her political opposites.
If we are interested in understanding each other, and if we are ultimately interested in policy that reflects what is good in the concerns of those who disagree, the only way we're going to get any sense of what that is if we can acknowledge what is good in the position of the other, acknowledge what troubles us about our own position. You know, I don't understand how you can work on an issue for 35 years and never change your mind at all about anything.
When we talk about abortion, we collapse it to two sides, and each side famously demonizes the other. No issue is more a symbol of culture war and of the way we've impoverished our collective approach to intimate, complex human questions. This hour for the Civil Conversations Project, we explore new possibilities quietly unfolding. Frances Kissling has been at the center of the abortion debate and was the longtime president of Catholics for Choice. Some dubbed her the abortion queen. In recent years, she's given herself to pursuing real relationship, a whole new kind of conversation and encounter with her political opposites. She's experienced something more powerful, as she tells it, than defining common ground. We'll listen beyond the pros and cons of abortion to how this has changed her and what she's learning that might be useful for us all.
The need to approach others with enthusiasm for difference is absolutely critical to any change. You know, like, I'm the toughest of fighters, and, you know, and I love a good fight, and I love to win. But I think what I have learned is that you have got to approach differences with this notion that there is good in the other. And that if we can't figure out how to do that, and if there isn't the crack in the middle, where there are some people on both sides who absolutely refuse to see the other as evil, this is going to continue.
From American Public Media, I'm Krista Tippett. Today on Being, listening beyond life and choice. Frances Kissling's unfolding wisdom on human and social change from inside the abortion debate.
Thank you. So I'll put the link for that interview. Is, I think, about 40 minutes or something like that. I'll put the link to that interview on our Facebook page. And I'll also put the links to the two TED Talks that we took clips from on our Facebook page. And I'll put a link to another guy whose name is Robert Jensen. He's a professor of School of Journalism at University of Texas. And he wrote a book several years back called Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. And I'll put a link to him, his work, and that book. And I'll put a link to Dan Finke, who's a really interesting guy. He used to be an academic, and now he's a private practice philosopher.
My dream.
So, yeah, if you need philosophical advice, you can actually go to him and pay him a bit of money, and he'll give you philosophical advice. And he does speaking engagements and all kinds of things. But he's come up with guidelines for a civil dialogue, and I'll put all those links on our Facebook page.
Nice. So many great resources.
Any last-minute thoughts that you have before we wrap it up here on this episode of Thinking Clearly?
I'm just ready to take you down next month.
Oh, you're getting your mitts up already.
Yeah.
Remember this civil dialogue. We're going to have a facilitator.
Well, all right.
Okay.
She can separate us.
All right. Well, thank you for the calls, and thank Eric for his fine engineering. Good to see him back in that chair, and we'll see you again next month.
Little man, don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD People Powered Radio.